meow, meow. Got a meow there for me, Brother Phil.
Yeah.
Trigger warning, this is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from the wild mountain west of America from an undisclosed location. The Freedom Fiends trigger your locus coeruleus and zap you with freedom, tasing you with liberty since 2011. This is Michael Dean, Michael W. Dean. We got Phil W. Warmoth. Now, what's your middle initial there, Phil Warmoth?
That'd be a C, big C.
Yeah? What's that stand for?
Clark.
Cool. Clark? I didn't know you that. I've known you since college. I never knew your middle name. But, you know, that's on a need-to-know basis.
Right.
There it goes.
And I'm feeling it.
Are you feeling it? Good.
Yeah, I am.
Good. You're having a classic nor'easter there. I have
a little vent there.
What is it? How do you say it? I eat? No.
Yeah. That's how
that means darn tootin' in Mainer, right?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
How come you don't have a Mainer accent? And how come my friends Derek Slopey and Chandler St. Pierre also don't have Mainer accents?
I've lived here for 20 years. I don't know what happened, but
yeah.
I can speak it, but and I can understand it for the most part.
Why don't you do a couple minutes like in Mainer? Just speak
I don't know if you want that. Yeah, because like I've been working on this for a long time.
Really?
What you got going on down there?
Back off the mic there, Mainer. I'll call you Maynard. Maynard Ferguson.
I paint in the summer, right? And I meet all kinds of people.
Oh, you're an artist?
Yes, I am. I'm a house artist. Yeah, yeah.
Paint houses. Yeah.
Yes, pastel, acrylic, whatever you want, man. But I met this one guy in particular. Like, as soon as I got to the job, I knew I didn't want it because, number one, the guy was sitting there and he told me that he built this house, right? And it was a three-story house, and like when you get up to like, you know, 2-3 stories, you need someone else to help you up set up a ladder because you need a 32-footer, right? And I wasn't into that either. And the guy, but he was a drunk, man, and he had the old potty mouth and everything, and so like I kind of said, hey, look, man, I can't do it. I'm busy, you know.
Dagnabbit.
And every time I went to the Walmart to the beer section, he'd be there in his little cart thing, and he'd be like, oh, come on, you can come over just when you're done with a job. Come on over, Dan, and I'll help you set up the ladder. And I'm like, how is that even possible, man? You're in the wheelchair, you know? So I just blew the thing off completely, and I still run into the guy every once in a while, and now he cusses me out all the time, so it's okay, but like,
wow. Did you do the job or did not?
No, I didn't. And as my friend said, you know, the guy said,
it's a good way to make some extra money there.
And I'm like, there's no such thing as extra money, you know?
Yeah, it's true. That's like, there was a band, one of the funniest band names I've ever heard of. There's this band in New York City called Leftover Crack.
I think
the joke is because there's probably no such thing. I wouldn't know.
Right.
But, yeah.
Extra money. Yeah, I get
extra
it.
Extra crack. Yep.
Right. Wow.
I thought all painters were drunks.
You know, actually, that's a myth. But there's always one or two people that really kind of like fulfill the myth. I was painting for this old-timer guy, man. He was funny as anything, man. Down on the coast there. Place called Winter Harbor. And he was real lonely. He was this old timer, and he'd come out and he'd sit there and just talk to me the whole time I was painting. And he said he was watching this guy next door paint for his neighbor, and the neighbor had to go to like 20 miles away to Ellsworth, where I live, to buy him a quart of whiskey every day, man, that he came to paint.
From you?
And one day...
From you?
No, not for me. No, for this guy, right? This guy that was painting the neighbor's house. And
no, I said from you.
No.
You make whiskey?
No. I'm just in Ellsworth, so that was just like a point of
You could have a Monero mining rig in your basement or Bitcoin mining rig and use the heat it generates to run the still.
Well, that's a thought, man.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, so one day, my customer was out there and he watched the guy fall from like a, you know, 20-foot ladder. Just bam, right straight up on the ground. And yeah, it wasn't pretty, man. But anyway, yeah. So one day, if you want to hear a painting story, it's kind of funny. One day, yeah. I get there, and so a picture this, it's like right on
the
coast.
Well, it is Christmas, so it's Christmas here for about 45 more minutes. So, yeah, give me a painting story.
I'll give you a warm Christmas painting story. So it's this place is right on the coast. It's only been painted once in like 100 years, so there was lead paint on it, right? And I was trying to do all this stuff, and there were vines all over the place. I had to like scrape off these vines,
kudzu,
these like sticker things on them, and yeah, anyway, so I'm there one day and get all set up and I'm like, what is that smell, man? And the guy goes, he goes I got me a family of skunks living under the shed there. And so apparently what happened was he sat up all night with a shotgun, and mind you, he's like right in the middle of this little town, right? A shotgun and a flashlight, and he waited for one of the skunks.
That's all you need.
Pop. Yeah, no doubt, man. He waited for one of the skunks to pop its head out of the hole, and he shot it, but he wounded it, and it crawled up underneath, and it died under there, man. And so I'm trying to paint, and like I'm smelling this, and I'm like, what is going on, man? But he was telling me all these interesting stories from World War II.
Stories, like literally.
Yeah. He was a paratrooper, right? And he's like, darn those British sons of you know what? They dropped him behind enemy lines to do some reconnaissance, I guess, and they dropped him right over a concentration camp. So he said, as he was like parachuting down, he watched the German commandant walk out to greet him. And he thought he was going to be shot in the air, right? There was nothing he could do. And he gets down and gets himself together. And the commandant said, and he said in very perfect English, he said, you're going to be here for a while. And being the guy that he was, like, he's just like this funny guy. He became a trustee, like, right away. So one of his jobs was to clean the German officers' area, and he said he was stealing schnitzels and sausages and sticking them up his arms and stuff and giving them to the other prisoners, you know, the Holocaust kind of victim people. And he befriended these two Jewish brothers who ended up surviving the war, and come to find out they had all their money stashed in Swiss bank accounts, and they were millionaires. They were diamond merchants, actually, before the war.
Did they got their money back? Because I know, didn't the Swiss also, like, hide the Nazi money?
Yeah, they ripped off a lot of people. Yep. These guys got it back.
They hid Nazi money that was stolen from the Jews a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's correct.
Some would say that's just, you know, capitalism. They're playing both sides, so... But
yeah,
I think there was a big settlement recently where some people got some, you know, relatives of people got some money back from some of those banks are still banks.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, sure.
I was joking about the capitalism thing. You know, I was, you know, what is it in a time of war? You know, the true capitalist sells bombs to both sides. So,
right.
Did you ever see that movie? Oh, you done with that one? I don't want to cut into
another story. I'm all done.
That's interesting. Yeah. Did you ever see that? God, there was a movie about the Jewish ghetto uprising. You ever seen that one? With
not sure.
The guy, I think it was called Uprising. Uprising. Yeah, because you know that, like,
is that the Warsaw Ghetto?
Yeah. Because a lot of people don't know about this, and this is like something that those people with guns often point to as an example of, like, you know, people I say, like, well, you know, maybe guns will help if someone tries to rob you, but, you know, you're never, what are you going to do, overthrow the government? The government's never going to be corrupt. And it's kind of funny, too, because, like, all of the leftists that were screaming a couple years ago, you know, or a year ago, you know, Trump's a Nazi. Now they're like, Trump, you need to take away all the guns. You know, and last year they're like, We need guns because Trump might be a Nazi. I don't know. There's so much disconnect there. But
right.
This movie, yeah, it's called Uprising, and it's got Hank Azaria, who does a lot of the voices on The Simpsons, and David Schwimmer from Friends, but it's not a comedy. It's a really serious movie, and it's based on a true story, and it's about the ghetto uprising in Warsaw in 1943, which was basically, you know, everybody, a lot of Jews are being, and other people, Jews, homosexuals, right, intellectuals,
gypsies,
dissidents, sure, anybody who just didn't go along with it. I think a lot of, like, religious prosecution also on, what are those people, the religious people that knock on your door? Latter-day, not Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah, they were killed too. And so a lot of Jews went along with it because they didn't realize that, like, those trains ended in death. Right. They thought they were just being moved out of their neighborhood and ended up in work camps and then ended up dying. And then, you know, some people that got out or knew someone who knew a soldier or something, like, rumors started happening of, like, if you get on that train, you'll end up dead. Right. So people stopped. Like, a lot of people didn't believe it, still got on the train voluntarily, and there was a small group of people, like, I don't know, I think it was maybe 100 or 70 people in Warsaw who resisted. And a lot of them died, but a few of them got out. And they really gave the Nazis a run for their money with, like, nothing. With, you know, like, one guy had a broken revolver, and so they went up and, like, asked a Nazi guard for a light for their cigarette, while another guy came up behind the Nazi guard and shot him in the back of the head. Then they took his rifle, his uniform, and the chocolate in his pocket. So then a Jew would dress up as a Nazi and go up to five more Nazis speaking German and then, like, shoot them all. So wow. It was a, you know, it was a guerrilla uprising where they amassed weapons by starting with, like, one gun or a couple guns.
Wow.
It's pretty awesome.
Hmm.
Yep. It's really, it's a really dire movie, but it's really good. I recommend it for anybody, but especially for anybody who thinks that citizens shouldn't have guns. And especially if, you know, if you're one of these people who thinks it can't happen here for a long time, and now you're suddenly like, it might happen here.
Right.
I just had to bring politics into it, didn't I, Phil?
Okay.
All right, we'll be back. That's what I do.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000. It's entirely fictional.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep. But always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback and for the first time on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends related things, please rate and review. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
Oh, hi, I didn't see you come in there. We got a plan. We're a man. Or two. With a plan. Hey, Phil, you wrote me an email this morning and said, simply, and nothing else, and so it has come to pass, my brother. What the heck was that? I didn't get it.
Oh, that was the thing about the picture that you wanted to post for this show. Remember? That
was of the mice? Yeah. The hamsters?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. For those of you who are on Grandpa's internet, which is what we call terrestrial radio. For those of you who are only on Grandpa's internet and don't hear us on the web and don't see our webpage, log on to our webpage at HTTP. Remember when ads used to say that? Like they'd spell out the whole right. thing? Remember that? Yeah. http://.
You lost me at the last T there.
/// www.com/
I forget.
earthlink.com.net tilde warmest.
How do you connect up to that satellite there? I don't know.
Log on. We are coming through satellites right now. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, sure, man.
Yeah, we go, let's see, we connect via Fiend phone through the internet. You're in Maine. I'm in, where am I? Wyoming.
Right.
To Minnesota. Like, everywhere is cold that we're dealing with. Like, Maine and Wyoming connecting to Minnesota. Yeah, we might as well be in Canada. And then that sends the info over the internet to Atlanta. And then Atlanta sends it up to a satellite, and then a satellite sends it down all over America, and the radio stations, Ron, pick it up. It takes about a second or a second and a half, tops.
It's amazing.
You know, it's practically live, but then some stations play us days later, or tomorrow, or on the weekend, but some are live. So, yeah, we're broadcasting into space, so we're hoping that sooner or later the aliens at the possibly habitable planet at Alpha Centauri, 4.5 light years away, will hear us. Actually, they probably already heard us because we've been on the radio for about 5 years now. So the first broadcasts are just reaching them, and they're finally going, oh, we've been listening to this planet for 100 years. There's been nothing but lunacy and idiocy from here. I Love Lucy was pretty good, but this is the first thing we've heard since then that's intelligent life. Nice. And then they're going to come down here and give me their advanced state-blocking technology, and I'll just be able to put a big dome over my house that, like, you know, the tax man and the fuzz and the criminals can't get into. And then I'll be able to put those domes over my friends' houses. And then eventually I'll get all my friends and their loved ones and their pets together, and we'll move to Alpha Centauri. And, it's kind of my like second coming idea, but it's in the form of aliens from Alpha Centauri. And if that sounds crazy, like something from another planet, well, wait until we get into talking about this movie that Phil probably didn't see today. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, I didn't have a chance. Yeah.
Well, I'll talk about it, because the title and topic of this show is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's kind of not. It's called Artist Versus Audience. And the basic idea is Phil and I chat a lot by email, because we were really good friends in college, and then we drifted apart for about 45 years. No, about, let's see. When did I last see you? I last saw you when we went to meet my daughter, right? That was one of the last times
I
saw you.
Yeah. So
which was
80s.
In 80. Yeah. She was born in 84. That was 85. She was about one. And then did we ever, I think we emailed once, maybe. Maybe not.
Well, I saw Bomb live in Seattle with my wife, remember?
Nope.
I don't know if you remember.
I was drinking
a lot. Must have been 90, mid. No, because we were there.
It's ringing a bell. Was it at the off ramp?
Yeah, we're there.
Or at the other place?
Well, funny story. I don't know if I even told you about this.
Tell me.
You told me where you were going to be, and we couldn't find the place. It was so underground, we could not find it. There weren't even any cars parked on the street.
That's a compliment to me.
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah, it was a good show, too. You guys did a really good show, I remember.
Where was it?
It was in Queen Anne, like the Queen Anne section of Seattle. But it was on these side streets, and like there was nothing, man, nothing.
Do you know the name of the place?
I couldn't tell you.
Was there a crowd, or was it empty?
Yeah, it was a big. It was a big crowd. That was the part that I didn't understand. People park? Were they all pedestrians? Do you have a lot of pedestrian fans?
I bet you that, like, I don't understand how this music has an audience.
No, not at all. You guys were good. Yeah, it was good.
They teleported, man. They came from Alpha Centauri to see us. They just clicked their fingers together.
I think they did. But they were a good crowd.
Huh. Was I wearing a clown suit?
No, okay. Not that time.
Dude, I don't know what show it was, man. Were there guys from Nirvana there singing along up front?
I wouldn't have even known.
Wow. So that's the last time I saw you until recently. Worms.
Yeah.
We'll be back after this trip to the free market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this.
Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do!
To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
Dana Carvey's great.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. So, artist versus audience. So if you're on the Grandpa's internets and can't see our website, the picture we're going to use for the episode is... Describe the picture, Phil.
Yeah, it's kind of disturbing, actually. It's some kind of hamster revival session or something. I was moved, though, by seeing that. So
yeah.
It's
a hamster on his little plastic hamster house in his hamster cage, standing on top of it with his arms up in the air like he's a revival. And then there's three or four hamsters below him looking up at him. And we figured that we're the hamster on the house and y'all listening are the hamsters watching us. I think
artist and audience, yeah.
Yeah, artist versus audience. And I think what's really going on in that picture is probably somebody's holding food up and that one's trying to get it and the other ones don't see it yet. But I like to think it's a hamster revival. Right. And I don't really think, you know, artist versus audience. I'm with my audience, but remember that thing I sent you from Boston Tea Party this week about his policy if you want to contact him? He's a writer, he's a friend of mine who was really influential in my jaunt to liberty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about becoming a libertarian, and I know you're politically agnostic, which is libertarian enough for me to want to hang out with you, and you're a great artist. By the way, when are you going to record some more stuff? Because I want to make another record soon.
Yeah.
Even if we don't have much of an audience yet.
I'd like to. Yeah. I was telling you earlier, I think that's the way to go. I think books are kind of obsolete. I think
I'll pay for the next one. They're only $100 each to put out. I'll pay for it.
It's all right. Nah, we'll split it.
We'll split it. But, there we go. I'll take the 20, the $18 I made in royalties on the first record and put it in.
Hey, that's good. That's more money than I made out of all my books. Yeah.
Yeah. You lost money. You didn't.
Oh, totally.
You didn't
figure
out how to do it right. It's also gotten cheaper too, but, you know, it'd be really cool if Biptunia and Philtunia had five or six records before we hit it big. Because it's kind of like I really like binge-watching TV shows. Because now, you know, mm-hmm. Netflix and places like that, like they drop a whole season in one night. And,
sure.
You know, you sit around with your loved one and just watch it right. Like 16 hours a day for 3 days for the whole weekend. And I love it. That's like how it was meant to be. And that's how they got people off of, you know, network television or even cable television. Like I pay less than $30 a month for media subscriptions between Netflix, YouTube, Red, and whatever else I'm on. You know, and I was paying like $170 a month for cable TV just 2 or 3 years ago, and there was nothing to watch on it, man. Now there's like too much to watch. I love it.
Yeah.
But like people, you know, right now we got 30 or 40 hardcore fans probably, and you know, in a few years when we have six or seven records out.
Right. Yeah, you know, it could happen.
People discover us and they'll have six or seven records to go listen to and they'll all be great. Right. That'd be cool for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, you made me think about a lot of this artist. I don't know if it's artist versus audience. That happens at open mics.
Kind of.
Yeah, that happens at open mics when, you know, it's 9 o'clock at night, you're at a fisherman bar, and all they want to do is drink, and you are laying some poetry on them. But,
dude, I've done that with a loud rock band. Like, the poetry they can kind of ignore, but the loud rock band, you know, the regulars in the bar don't like that, especially since... Right. You know, if there's no one there, they're like, why are you playing and disturbing us? And if there's a big crowd there, they're like, who are these weird people in our bar?
You right. Know? Yeah. Yeah. It made me realize one time that I wasn't prepared for a heckler. I've never had a heckler before. In all the years I've been doing this.
They're
stuff.
Awesome.
Like, dude. But like I start. So there was a potential for one to happen for me one night. And I realized I was very unprepared. So I'm writing a poem. It's called One for the Heckler, you know, like just to have in my arsenal just in case, you know. But, you know, the idea for me of getting authentic feedback, that's what prompts me to get out and do these open mics. And that's what I did for my book. I would try out a poem. You know, I'd always have like a poem that was like a sure thing. A poem that I was, you know, writing in progress and I needed some feedback, and then just something that I was just throwing out there. And for 6 years I did that. So that's how everything came together for Venus Remembers.
Hecklers are not feedback, though. They're hecklers are usually like when people heckle, what it almost always means, unless they're the person who it's their regular bar and you're interrupting it, but you know, then they should talk to the bartender and say, hey, why don't you stop making money and just me and my three friends will help put you out of business and quit having bands here. right. or you know, most hecklers I think are just people who have a problem with themselves. They have a problem with someone else having attention. Actually, a lot of times, too, now, hecklers are social justice warriors. And, you know, you say, like, yeah, back in the 70s, I knew this dame. And they're like, dame, hi, how dare you? And they screech, you know.
Right.
You know, that's been going on for a long time. Because when I was working on this movie, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow, mm-hmm. I got some amazing resources. Like, I got to borrow a stack of letters that had belonged to Selby. Like, his widow gave me this stack of, like, 50 letters that he'd typed back and forth. Nice. Like, he learned to write by typing to people that he'd see the next day, you know?
Huh.
Just to type, like, in the late 50s. And then, you know, after he became a writer and had Last Exit to Brooklyn, his big hit, and then he moved out to L.A., and he was still in touch with a few people, especially Gilbert Sorrentino, who was his childhood friend and his editor on Last Exit to Brooklyn and a couple of his other books on Grove Press, which I think was also, was it Grove? I forget. No, those Bukowski's. But, and, yeah, I think he did one on that. But, you know, it was like an editor he loved to work with, who he really collaborated with, and like, It was these two like great literary giants like writing back and forth, and I got to read their letters that no one had read, and then photocopy them all, and then photograph some of them to use snippets in the movie, and then send them back, and it was amazing. And one of the things too, like he was upset. Two things I can remember he was upset about, actually three things that he was upset about that were kind of telling to me. One was that he applied for. It wasn't the National Endowment of the Arts. He applied for the National Endowment of the Arts and, like, got turned down. It got turned down and turned down when he was starving. And then one year, like, he won, like, without applying. They were just like, yeah, we can't ignore you anymore. You're Hubert Selby. And it wasn't the National Endowment of the Arts, but it was one of those other, like...
Like the Guggenheim, you know, or something?
Yeah, it was one of those Lifetime Achievement Awards, but it was one you don't apply for. Like, he'd applied for a bunch and stuff for this one, but, you know, really, like, you're recommended by other people. You don't really apply for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they finally gave it to him, and he's like, he refused it, and it was, like, $5,000, and he was starving. But he's like, you didn't help me when I was really down and out, you know?
Right.
And he was still kind of down and out, but he refused it. That was bizarre and kind of cool, but kind of weird.
And then integrity, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, integrity to a fault to where it can hurt him, actually, you know? One was his book... The Demon or The Room, I forget which it was done on, like, Penthouse Press, which is kind of weird. Like, they got into literary publishing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And And the editor on that was like someone half his age that was just, you know, had a master's in English just out of college and was like, well, you're using this typographically wrong here, and you need a, and it, like, Selby had his own language. Like, he didn't use apostrophes, you know, kind of like E.E. Cummings, like, didn't use capitals. Right. Like, Selby had his own shorthand with things like that. He didn't use apostrophe unless it was needed, like on its versus ITS, but, you know.
Right.
And he didn't use quotes. You know, you just kind of could tell, because the characters were so strong, you could tell who was talking. And, you know, like, they didn't let him do that. Like Playboy Press, like, he was, like, almost suicidal over this, or just hating life because, you know, he didn't have his old editor who was his buddy who got him. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing he was upset about was one time he was invited by a professor to go speak at Occidental College in L.A., which is where Obama went later. But he went to speak at Occidental College. This is like in the 70s, and like people were screaming at him in this classroom and calling him a sexist. Like, you know, a couple of women like knew he was coming to speak, and students and just like wouldn't let him talk. And I mean, that happens now a lot, but it happened back then. Like, this is not new. And the thing that's bizarre is Selby was not a sexist. He was painting characters who were sexist. Bukowski was a sexist, and I'd say it's part of his charm. But, you know, even if you hate that kind of language, like, Bukowski was describing himself. Selby wasn't. He was describing people from the neighborhood where he grew up. And, you know, like, Selby didn't like to cuss a lot, but his characters would cuss, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And people didn't understand the difference. So that's an artist versus audience right there.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
Yep.
But we don't cuss.
You have a lot. Yeah, not on the radio. We don't cuss in our books and on our records, too. I've decided that for us.
I didn't anyway, you know.
You didn't anyway. Good.
Nah.
Good. Well, I've decided that I don't want to do that in music because I want my stuff to be able to play it anywhere. There's a lot of people who are like, oh, you're a sellout. I cuss like a freaking sailor off radio and off music, but it's like, I don't. This is something I got from Henry Rollins. Like, I interviewed him for my book, $30 Music School, which I'm actually putting out, working on the next edition of now. Finally, I got the rights back, so I can. It was going to be like 30 cent Music School on Kindle or something. No, probably like $2 Kindle Music School. But Henry Rollins said that his music is intense and angry and like violent, and but he doesn't cuss in it. He did in Black Flag, but not in his solo band, Rollins' band. And he says it's because he doesn't want anyone to be able to slap a sticker on it and say they can't play it on radio or they can't let their kids listen to it. I would rather be subversive and not cuss than cuss and not be subversive. You know?
Yeah. I just think it's a level of professionalism, too. You know? Like, sometimes people cuss because they can't think of any other thing to say.
And yeah.
I think being writers, especially poets and lyricists, you know, you're so deliberate about what you want to say that I just don't think it's necessary. But
yeah. And you edit, unlike a lot of poets. You and Selby edit. You're not a beatnik. You don't. I call this thing the beatnik lie. Have I told you about the beatnik lie?
No, but I think I know what you're talking about. But go ahead. Yeah, I want to hear it.
Tell me what you think the beatnik lie is, real quick.
Like Kerouac with On the Road.
Well, the beatnik lie is that the first edit is truth, and any editing dilutes the truth. And it's just a cop-out. And we'll be back after this trip to the market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Yeah. Freedom Fiends brought to you by Embril and Pregnazone. Not really. Your mileage may vary. Finally off Pregnazone again for those of you who are keeping track and playing the home game of Freedom Fiends. I'm off again. Yeah. I'll bet some of our listeners are on prednisone. It's one of the most commonly prescribed drugs because it, even though it has horrible side effects and you get addicted to it, it treats everything. And it's also like the cheapest drug. It's literally cheaper than aspirin, the generic form of it. I mean, it's like pennies a month to be on it. So, yeah. But then it, if you stop taking it cold turkey, you die. So you have to taper off that. It. And you taper off it like your muscles are just sore all the time. And also makes you really hungry. Turns you into a ravenous weasel. Just want to eat everything. All right. So we're talking about artist versus... I mean, I don't want to be one of those... I used to hate those people. Like, you know, I'd be in line at the bank and waiting or... checkout line, supermarket, and it'd be taking a long time because people would be like, oh, and my sciatica's acted up. You're like, I don't want to be the guy talking about my health problems on the radio.
Right.
I did that for a couple of years. All right, so artist versus audience. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but kind of not. Part of the reason it's kind of tongue-in-cheek is like, I mean, part of the reason it's kind of not is I kind of don't really want feedback from my audience, you know? I kind of do stuff in one direction. Like, I'll answer emails, and I'll take a lot of time with them sometimes, and I'll answer them pretty promptly sometimes. But, you know, like Boston Tea Party was saying in his, here are my demands if you want to email me. A lot of people just want to argue, and my answer to them is, like, go write your own book. Go make your own show. And it's I'm not only telling people, go make your own movie, leave me alone. I've written books and... have websites on how to do this, you know, like all my tips and tricks for tech stuff and getting stuff done free. My books, $30 Music School, $30 Film School, $30 Writing School, my website, creamyradioaudio.com. There's some more. I can't even remember them all. But, you know, there's really very little point in giving unsolicited feedback to an artist unless they're like, a kid starting out and they're asking you and you've been where they're gonna go. You know, like if you're an artist already and some kid who's on his way up asks you. Really, like I don't take advice from anybody who hasn't been where I'm going. And that was a problem too with health stuff, like when I got really sick. Like everybody and his brother tells me what's wrong with like what I have to do to get well. And like most of them have never been sick or had that illness. And you know, if I did everything that everyone told me to do, like, I'd be eating nothing, you know, and I'd be, like, sleeping in the yard or something. I don't know.
Right.
People and their advice. Yeah, and, you know, the thing about, like, if you want to write in, here's some advice. I'm not going to say this for us, although I'm really saying this for us. But if you want to tell an artist they're great, what really means more to them is if you write them a positive review on Amazon or iTunes or wherever, and then send them a link. Hey, I really like you. I did this review of you, and I have this question. Like, they're far more likely to take the 3 minutes to answer your question because you've kind of done them a favor. And I also believe that reviewing things is really important because a lot of our listeners are like me in that they think there should be far less or no government. And one of the staples of people who believe that is, you know, when people say, well, without the government, how would people make sure that their food isn't poisonous? Well, the food gets poisoned anyway, even with the FDA. I think that without the government, things would be done better by things like Consumer Reports, Angie's List, Amazon Reviews. You know, like, I don't need a government board to tell me what music I should listen to, although, like, Soviet Russia had that. China has that, had that. North Korea has that. Iran has that, you know. I'd rather people on Amazon, you know, write their reviews and then I read them and make up my own mind or I hear it from word of mouth. So that's one thing you can do to not be so versus, as an audience, not to be so versus with your artists. And they're not your artists. And a lot of people really think if they buy your record or your book, that you owe them something, which is ridiculous. But we'll have more.
I'm glad you brought
that
up. Yeah, we'll talk. Yeah. We'll talk more about that.
We got a record out. Our band's called Biptunia, Bravo India Pop Tango TUNIA, Biptunia, or Philtunia when Phil's on it. And if you go to Biptunia.com, you can listen free. You can buy it, or you can listen and then review it on Amazon. That's free and it's okay if you actually listen to it. If you have an Amazon account. And we got a book out. It's a little chap book. It's $5.55.
I love that book.
It's the compendium to that record. Yeah, I love that book, too. It's fun. It took me a day to put out. Less than a day to put together. And go to jipprod.org. J-I-P-R-O-D, right?
Jipprod.org.
I'll put that in the show notes.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell 411 has decentralized ride-sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell 411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell 411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
This is Freedom Fiends. You know who we are. Oh my God, they skipped the intro for 1 hour. What's wrong? We're good. Michael W. Dean, talking to Phil Warmoth. So we went to college together. Then you saw him a band play in Seattle, probably in the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah, it had to be early 90s.
And then didn't talk at all, or talked a little? Didn't talk at all, huh?
I don't know, yeah.
Till
kind of don't think
when
so.
Till like 3 months ago or something, right?
Yeah, and then within 3 months, we got an album and a book.
And working on another. Bad. Yeah, I have an idea. So I think you should start. I think it would be cool if you started recording the rest of the poems that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
I do that. And I already got another book in the works and
cool.
The novel, but working cool. On that. That's slow going. But yeah, definitely potential.
Yeah, novels take a while. Yeah, I think so. I'd like to get your poems recorded before I start working on it. Because last time I was largely fitting them to stuff I'd already written or kind of half written.
Right. Yeah,
and I mean one of them, like the Jamestown one, I wrote to it.
Yeah,
but I want to try something too. I want to have you read it to a metronome, like not record the metronome, but I'll record like 120 beats a minute. Send you a beat, uh-huh. Put it on your phone, put some earbuds in,
yeah.
Listen to it on your phone, over earbuds, with your headphones over it so the click doesn't leak much or at all into the mic, mm-hmm. And then record to that. Like, not really rapping in rhyme, but just kind of aware of the rhythm.
We'll see.
Try that with one song and see how that works.
Yeah, interesting that you brought that up, because what I'm working on now is kind of the same idea. I'm taking Crucifixion Street with the karaoke version that you sent me, the non-spoken word version, and trying to time it out so I can read it live. I want to perform it live through a wireless speaker. But like, there's that one section where, you know, your vocal's there, so like my timing has to be perfect. So it's a challenge, but I like it, and I think
it's a good challenge. I mean, really, what I would do is just listen to the final version with your talking a bunch more times, and maybe take some notes, kind of map out where stuff comes in.
Exactly. Yeah, write down the
or take your copy of the chat book and just put in. Yeah,
that's what I'm gonna do.
Because it's put in times.
Absolutely, that's what my plan was, and you know, it's shameless self promotion, which is always good. Right?
Yeah,
you know. So
you could actually, if you really want to cheat, you could have your watch laying in the chat book.
Yeah, I don't wear a watch, man.
Yeah, you could get one. They're like 99 cents now. Yeah. I don't wear rings or watches or I don't know. I started wearing kind of like weird biker rings and stuff that cost like $10. I like them. But yeah, cuz I can, cuz I've elevated myself financially to where I can buy a $10 ring now and like it.
Nice. No more gumball machine rings,
no,
right?
No. No Cracker Jacks. Yeah.
Piercings from the gumball machine. Yeah.
So artist versus audience.
Mm-hmm.
Audience versus artist could be too. Yeah, I kind of make myself overly available to people. I have over the years. And I'm kind of getting to where, I mean, you could say I'm kind of getting turning into a recluse, but mm-hmm. I kind of think of it more like maximizing my time. Like, I don't have time for, one thing I will not do is debate people in any way. Like, sometimes people disagree with me and they're like, you said I'm wrong. Let me on your show to debate you. And I'm like, nope, you're just trying to get free airtime. You know?
Right.
Counter me on your own show if you have one. No, I'm not giving you time.
Write me a poem.
And people act like if you say something negative about what they do that you owe them airtime. You don't. And,
yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I criticize a lot of people. You don't, and both are valid. Why don't you criticize a lot of people? Not saying you should, but why don't you?
I criticize myself. That's where I'm at. I don't feel the need to criticize because I'm not going to change anything anyway, you know, and who am I to say what's good or bad or indifferent, you know? I worry about myself, and that's why I edit my stuff so much, unlike the beatnik ethic.
Those darn filthy beatniks.
Shooting
their wives in Mexico.
Right, yeah, just, you know, just for fun. No, but, yeah, I don't, you know, and I love this collaboration that we're doing because
me too.
It totally embodies everything that I feel about this topic, which is, you know, you gotta give something up, man. You gotta like compromise. You gotta be willing to work with other people's ideas and like feed off of it rather than criticize and shut it down, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why this thing works and like it's worked right from the get go.
Yeah, it really has. I don't think we've had any arguments either. I think the only time we approached an argument was we were emailing about something, and it wasn't even about art. It was about, like, the world or something. And it was one of those things where there was a miscommunication because it was text only, and then we got on the phone, and it was fine.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, that's the pitfall of this whole electronic thing.
But I love it, though. I love electronic. It's what I've been waiting for my whole life. Like, when the internet came around, or when the web came around, I got on it really early. Like, I actually was on the internet, and I was on the internet in, like, 92 at the San Francisco Public Library, but it wasn't the web. It was this thing called Gopher, which was, like, text-based green screen monochromatic monitor. You had to know all these commands to, like, you know, access files on university sites that were public. And it wasn't that interesting to me. And then I kind of worked at what I consider the first web cafe ever, which was kind of weird. Like, when I first got sober in 94 off of being a junkie for a bunch of years and then being a drunk before that, like, the only jobs, like, you know, I'd been like a rock star, you know, budding rock star, signed to Warner Brothers, touring the world. And then suddenly, like, the band broke up because of my drug use. And then I got sober a year later. And I was useless, man. I couldn't do anything except, like, have sex and play bass. And nobody would pay me to do either, of course. You know, and I really, you know, never asked for money for sex. And, you know, rarely made a lot of money at much money. Yeah, I made like a plumber's wage for 1 year at music and then was starving the rest of the time I was a musician. So plumber's wage is pretty good, but that was 1 year. 1 year or two, 1 year and a half. So then you know, I was doing jobs that, like, I was like 30 doing jobs that, like, teenagers did. Like, for a while I was an elevator operator at a school, like a ballet school. And, like, they still have it, like, one elevator with elevator operators in San Francisco. And then I was a dishwasher and sometimes a bar back when they needed one at this restaurant at 9th and Folsom in San Francisco. And the reason I mention this corner is because, and it would be the, let's see, north, northeast corner, I think, of that. So that property has been, it's one of those doomed properties where there's like every 11 months there's a new business, you know, like every 9 months or something, like it closes, you know, a business goes out of business, it's empty for a few months, then a new business comes in with bright ideas and happy thoughts, and then they're just out of business in 9 months or something. And it wasn't a cafe, it was like a steak restaurant and bar that had four or five computer terminals back when like almost nobody had computers in their home and definitely not connected to the World Wide Web. This is really early, like late 94, early 95, I think. And the reason they went out of business was they didn't realize that people wanted privacy with what they did on the internet. The monitors were up on the wall.
Wow.
So you'd like eat your steak and try to surf your porn. People try to surf porn and like, you know, they'd be embarrassed and leave. So I do believe that was possibly the first like place that served food and internet access with your food. But
wow.
I worked there and I got really interested in it. You know, and when I'd stay after I was like, you know, when I was cleaning up, I'd jump on the computers and poke around on the web. And I was like, this is amazing. This is what I've been waiting for my whole life. Like when I was a kid, I used to write letters to like, they'd have pen pals in the back of magazines. You ever do that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah,
really?
Man. Yeah.
Wow. When I was like 11, I wanted to put a message in a bottle. And I put a message in a bottle. My dad helped me write it and said, like, you know, if you find this, write to me and put our home address. I would never put my home address on something like that now. But,
yeah.
You know, and we went out and like to Lake Erie when it was frozen, you know, for like a half mile out. And I threw it in the ice.
Nice.
And I forgot about it. And like 6 months later, I got a letter from Buffalo, like 70 miles away. Somebody found this thing.
That's cool.
And my dad, I got the local paper over this. Like, you know, and it just made me think about, like, there's a world out there. There's a world past my yard, you know?
Yeah.
And I was always trying to receive information that wasn't available at my local library. I used to live in the library. Did you live in the library?
I did for... Really? Many, many years, especially, well, going to college, yeah, but even before that, I had this really crappy apartment in Jamestown, and the heater didn't work. There was one little monitor heater, gas heater.
So you'd go to the library to stay warm?
Basically, I was hanging out with a lot of people who were in the same boat as I was, a lot of homeless people and stuff, and... I had a heater,
but I had fleas, remember, that I couldn't get rid of.
This place I was living at, like, basically I was running off of this little oil-filled radiator electric thing that I plugged in.
You didn't have fleas because it was too cold.
Exactly.
I had a heater, so I had, the fleas didn't die. Yeah.
I guess there's an upside and downside to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I spent a lot of time in the library, and while I was there, I just, you know, I educated myself. I started...
Yeah, me too. That's why I used to skip class so I could get an education at the library.
Yeah, isn't that funny, man?
Yeah.
But
That's a good library at JCC, Community College. We're sending them... I wrote a letter, and you like the little draft of it.
We're sending a copy of our
chapbooks, our poetry chapbooks to them. And talking about how we went there. Because they have a couple of my books. Like one I sent them and one they got on their own. So they'll put them in. Cool. They'll put them in the card catalog. It'll be cool.
Yeah, nice, man.
Yeah. So what are you going
to
say?
Nothing.
Okay.
I got nothing, man.
Well, good. Because we're going to go buy some things at the free market.
Sweet.
And then we'll be back to talk about Gray State. We're really going to talk about it. I don't want to pimp it and not talk about it. We'll be back.
Right.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. Go to biptunia.com. That's B-I-P-T-U-N-I-A. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha. Biptunia.com.
Oh, I think I sent the worms thing to me, not to you.
Yeah, I didn't see it. Retroactive right. Worms coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Better worms than never.
I always say that.
Yep. Yeah, Biptunia is now on Deezer, whatever that is, D-E-E-Z-E-R, Philtunia. Both Biptunia albums are on there. I'm calling it Biptunia, and then, you know, in parentheses, sometimes saying Philtunia, because it's too confusing for people to find it if I call it just Philtunia. It's not going to show up, because they're going to look Biptunia. I'd rather, it's, you know, a brand within but it's a brand, yeah.
Right.
So it's you're a member of Biptunia now. For now, we'll see how it goes.
Don't kick me out of the band, man.
You're on probation. I'm kidding. I don't really have probation. It's just like I do stuff with people until it's not fun. You know.
I hear you.
And you're still fun. So.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad you're still fun too, man.
There's like 10 ex Freedom Fiends that have quit or been fired listening, going, Phil. Phil, you're going to... There's a guy named Phil. There's an ex-fiend named Phil probably listening going, Phil, you don't know what you're in for. Nah, you do. You knew me back then. None of these people knew me back then.
Right.
Yeah. You knew me when I was drunk.
It was good back then. I mean, we did some good stuff back then.
Yep.
Yep.
So... Speaking of people that do good stuff, so I don't interview people very often. It's kind of funny, like people will write to me and say, interview me, I'm blah, 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 or interview my friend. And like, put it this way, if I want to interview you, I've already heard of you. Or, you know, like you, I wanted to interview, and I'm like, why interview him? Just make him a co-host, man. You know?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
That makes sense. Because it also, like the way we do shows, like, we don't... Freedom Fiends don't take phone calls. Phone calls sound horrible. Most people don't have a good mic set up. Like, there's a learning curve to have good enough audio to be on the Freedom Fiends. And that sounds snobby, but it's like... No, I don't want to put out crap, you know?
Right.
I don't want to put out crap to have, like, people call in and have bad audio. Some of them have good audio. Most of them sound bad. To like, argue with me when I know I'm right.
Or, can you play Misty for me?
Or, you know, lay conspiracy theories on me that I just go, ugh. So, I'm going to indulge a possible conspiracy theory tonight because, like, I've done, like, 10 interviews in my life. I mean, I've done... This show's in, like, I don't know, 1,200-some episodes, and I've done other podcasts for years, and, you know, I've probably made 2,000 episodes of, like, radio-like content in my life, and probably less than 15 of them have been interviews. Like, who have I interviewed? I interviewed Chris Novoselic from Flipper because I really respect him, and because the respect is mutual because he liked my music. Also, it was pretty cool to get him on record saying that Kurt Cobain liked my band Bomb and turned him on to Bomb.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's fun. And let's see, I interviewed Cody Wilson, the inventor of the printable gun. Do you know about the printable gun, Phil?
I don't.
You know what a 3D printer is?
Yep.
Well, there's a guy named Cody Wilson who, about 4 or 5 years ago, he was a law school student in Austin, and he's like, you know, I'll bet you could print a gun with one of these that would work. And he did, and people said, oh, you're going to blow yourself up, blah, blah, blah. And he was talking about how he's going to do this before he did it, and I contacted him, and he'd never done an interview, and he's like, you know, I don't think I want to do interviews. I don't really want to, you know, make waves with this. I just want to put it out there. And I was like, I talked him into doing an interview. I'm like, no, you have to do an interview. you need to do interviews. This is too important not to do interviews. And he's really kind of shy. And, like, that was his first interview. And and now he's, like, unstoppable force of nature. Like, you know, Wired magazine named him one of the, like, 20 most dangerous people in the world. And, you know, he got interviewed by Glenn Beck. And Glenn Beck's like, I think you're a dangerous man, Cody Wilson. I don't know if I like this idea. I love the Second Amendment. But if anyone can just print them. And he's like, hey, what do you think shall not be infringed means, man? You know? So it was, and the guns aren't very good. I mean, they're like single shot, 380. You know, they're good for, they're accurate at about 5 feet or 10 feet. They're, you know, I gave him some advice on it too, like he, on that interview. And he, you know, I said, first of all, when you test fire your first one, don't hold it in your hand. Put it in a vise and put a string on the trigger and be like 20 feet behind a wall, you know? And he said, like, yeah, and the only problem I've had is like, I can't 3D print a plastic pin to hit the primer. And I'm like, use a nail. Anybody can get a nail. It's not cheating to have one part be a nail. And he's like, oh, okay, you know. And also said use a small caliber. I said 22, and he ended up with 380. But so I interview people like that who end up important or I like, and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Through the bushes and the hedges of liberty with our poems. I'm just sitting here polishing my bayonet with my poems. Yeah.
You too?
Yeah. No, you too thinks we should be disarmed. They don't like us to have bayonets. All right, so speaking of right to keep and bear arms, so there's this guy named David Crowley who was an aspiring filmmaker. He was a really good filmmaker who I heard of in, boy, what year was that? Maybe 2012. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Okay, I heard about he was making this film called Gray State. And it was called that because it was kind of about, it was like, you've seen Red Dawn, right?
Yeah.
Phil? Okay, so,
yeah.
So Gray State was kind of like Red Dawn, except instead of the enemy being Russia and mm-hmm. Cuba, the enemy was the United States federal government.
Huh.
You know, it's like not too distant future, cameras everywhere, kind of 1984-ish, cop mm-hmm. on every corner, police state, you know, kind of like now, but amped up really bad. You know, like people having to get, you know, scanner chipped. Codes right. chipped. Yeah, like they show a kid getting chipped in it. And, you know, FEMA is going around with a guillotine, chopping off heads of dissidents and things like that. And, you know, these brave patriots led by, you know, some ex-military dudes and just some neighborhood guys get together and fight it and win. So he made this trailer for it. And it was stunning. It was freaking mind-blowing. I mean, it looked like Hollywood, and he made it on zero money. And this was, that's easier now. It was a lot harder in 2012. Like, the technology hadn't quite caught up as much. I mean, it looked amazing, and he had, like, it looked like casts of thousands. And, you know, as a filmmaker, I've never made a drama like that. I mean, I've done some little scenarios. Like, in Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, there's some little, like, vignettes that are kind of funny but kind of make a point. Like the one where I'm in the closet clutching my rifle, polishing the bayonet, in a closet on the phone, screaming that, like, you know, calling the police and saying, like, the IRS is here. They're trying to take my guns or something. I don't know. But his thing was really not funny at all. It was really, it was deadly serious and terrifying and really well done. Like, somebody actually called it, like, you know, prepper porn or conspiracy porn, you know, because it, like, amped you up. But he was not, he wasn't stupid. I'm not saying those people are stupid, and I'm kind of a little bit of a prepper myself, but he was very intelligent, and I interviewed him, and he said that, and I'll link the interview in the show notes of this. So he did an interview with me, and I talked to him like we weren't friends, but I liked him, and I kind of feel like I had a connection with him because I did this interview with him, which is over an hour long, and it was about 45, 50 minutes, and then I talked to him for like 45 minutes before that because he was jogging when I called him, and he's like, well, I can't really, I'm a little out of breath, but we can pregame a little bit. We ended up pregaming for like 45 minutes. Then he got home and called me back after he rested a few minutes, and then we did the interview, and it was great. It was done over a phone, so the audio is not amazing, but it was really deep, and he said that when he first started making this movie, like, he was ex-military, but, and he had, you know, he joined up right after 9/11, I think, and he was really gung-ho and, like, served a bunch of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then finally he was, like, done with it, and they were like, okay, next year you get out, and he finally was done, and he came home, and he's, like, ready to start civilian life, and then a few months later, the Army's, like, did the stop-loss thing. They're like, nope, you're coming back to Iraq, which they've been doing, which is, you know, part of the reason that, and I'm not saying this is what happened to him. This is part of the reason that, like, I don't know if you know this or not, Phil, but more U.S. military die now from suicide than from war. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, no.
Isn't that mind-blowing, man?
It's horrible, yeah.
It's horrible, yeah. So, you know, he was deeply patriotic, but he was libertarian, and he, you know, he, as he got older, he got more and more what I call woke, you know, what the kids call woke. Like, he got really knowledgeable and really started looking at, like, you know, I love my country, but what we're doing over there is not good. That's the conclusion he came to, and he really didn't want to be involved in it, and they made him go back. And that last time they made him go back, like, something clicked in his brain, and he's like, I've got to make this movie, you know? And even so, he said that when he started writing the script for it, like, it was just kind of an idea for a movie. Like, well, I like filmmaking. I went to film school, you know, on the GI Bill. I'm going to make this film. And it was just an idea for a film. And the more he got involved in it, the more it became like a driving mission. Like, I have to do this. The world needs this. And he made this trailer, and the trailer got like 500,000 views. I mean, it really went, it blew up. And then he got interviewed. I interviewed him. And then like a week later, a few days later, he got interviewed by Alex Jones, who's on our network too, and has, you know, about 1 million more listeners than we do. And it kind of went viral. Like, you know, his stuff all has millions of views, and he got interest in funding from people in Hollywood, and he became really intensely artistically obsessed with this. And I'll go back to more of that, but jump ahead, because you don't know this part probably. You know, a few years ago, he was found dead in his home with a gunshot to his head, next to his wife, who had a gunshot in her head, next to his little 6-year-old girl, who had a gunshot in her head.
No, oh, man.
I know. And it's like he had everything. Like, he was, you know, smart and really talented and really driven. And he was handsome and healthy and physically in shape and, you know, jogged every day. And his wife was all those things, too. And she was, like, independently running this consulting firm doing, you know, nutritional stuff, and she's really good at it. She was building a business with a partner, this other woman, and like everything looked perfect for them. And then he's found dead. And this is like the murder mystery of the century. And I thought this when I heard about it. I'm like, duh, this guy didn't kill himself. He was one of the most full of life people I've ever met. And people are like, well, yeah, but you know, depression comes on quick, and sometimes being happy hides it, and people can be manic depressive, and maybe he had PTSD, and you know, maybe he was overworked from working on this movie. And then it came out, and this was like, you know, a couple miles from where GCN is. Like, our board op remembers this from the local paper when it happened. And like, they were dead for a week or two before they were found. Like, you know, the Christmas, it's weird that there's the documentary, Barry and Lee, there's a documentary. The movie he was working on was called Gray State. It was never finished, but this documentary is called A Gray State, and it's produced by one of my favorite filmmakers. God, what's his name? God did Grizzly Man. Yeah, my favorite filmmaker.
Herzog, right?
Herzog, yeah, Werner Herzog. Yeah. Yeah. And who also made Grizzly Man and Fitzcarraldo and a bunch of other great movies. And all, like, it's not judgmental. Like, I thought they were going to be, you know, like it was going to tell you, oh, this is what happens when you vote for Ron Paul. You kill your family and then you're, you know, like I thought it was going to be like that because Netflix kind of painted it like that. Like the Netflix, I got an email from Netflix today. They released this on Christmas, which is really weird because the family was found dead a few years ago, right after Christmas, because the Christmas presents were piling up on his porch, and they were there like 3 days after Christmas. The neighbor went over to get the presents because they thought they were out of town, and he was going to hold them to give them to him when he came back, and then knocked on the door and heard the dog barking insanely and looked through the window and saw the bodies and called the cops. And, yeah, this disturbs me, man. It's so disturbing, and it's like no one knows what happened, and the police didn't really try too hard to solve it. You know, they said, oh, murder, suicide. You know, first of all, because they were under immense, like, international pressure to close this case. Second of all, because a bunch of people were screaming, the government did it. Which, maybe they did. I don't know. But, and there were, like, really weird details, like, the written in her blood on the wall, it said Allah Akbar. And she had been Muslim. And this is like a theory I've never heard, but I'm thinking, like, you know, I'm not accusing anyone in her family or anything, but maybe someone who was Muslim who didn't like her. She converted to Christianity when she married him. And maybe they didn't like it. And maybe it was done by outsiders. But I don't know. Maybe it was done by the government because he was revealing information that people needed. Maybe he killed himself. Maybe she killed them. I don't know, because this is some stuff I didn't know that's in this movie is like, and I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I just want to say, like, these are all the possibilities, you know. And, of course, like, all of the, you know, bayonet polishers who were behind this movie from the start were like, you know, oh, the government did it as soon as it happened, which maybe they did. I mean, here's the thing. Like, the guy left so many crazy clues about his kind of descent into, I wouldn't say madness, but I'd say anxiety over making this film that it would have been easy to kill him and make it look like he did it. I mean, he left like videos on YouTube, like, I'm breaking down. This is too much pressure. I can't stand this, you know? And then like, the really freaky thing is there's a recording on his phone. His dad's in this movie and his dad plays this recording from his phone. Spoiler alert, but there's really no spoiler alerts with documentaries, I think, because they happened. I would say overall, though, this movie's really, like, doesn't pick sides. It's like any Herzog movie. Like, you make the decision. He gives all the facts. There's one really weird thing in it where the dad is reading off a paper. You don't know what he's reading. It could be the police report. It could be something he wrote. It could be something his son wrote. It could be something the wife wrote. It could be something the producers wrote. And it's like, it's kind of out of context near the end. And he's like, you know, and later that Christmas morning, he killed his family. Like, really, Dad? You gonna go with that? I was wondering if that was like false editing. That was my only problem with the whole movie. Like, you know, like maybe they said, this is the police report. Read it and tell us what you think. And maybe he read it and said, this is absurd. My son didn't kill himself. But I don't think Herzog would do that. But they were like, did you see Grizzly Man, the movie?
No, I didn't. Mm-mm.
It's a Herzog movie. This is directed by another guy. But it's a Herzog movie. Like, Herzog and this producer, I can't remember the guy's name, but he and the director, like, they produce on each other's movies and direct on each, you know, like you produce on my movie, I'll produce on your movie, you know. And it's very Herzog, and it's very Grizzly Man, which is another movie that's made, like, this movie's mostly found footage and then interviews with people who knew him. Grizzly Man is found footage. It's about this hippie guy that went and lived among the bears and ended up getting eaten by them in Alaska with his girlfriend. And there's like audio of him being eaten. We'll be back.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agrist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar. and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agoristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agorist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agoristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agoristhosting.com.
I'm the Freedom Fiend. This is Michael Dean. I'm talking to Phil Warmoth. Phil Cool Warmoth. Cool is his middle name.
Yeah.
So, we're talking about Gray State. We're talking about a Gray State. The movie about Gray State went up on Netflix today. And I'd say it's bad taste that they put it out on Christmas. But, you know, everyone's drunk, dealing with their family, talking to people they don't want to talk to. Talk to you once a year, twice a year. You know, you can either end up in the hospital or you can watch a movie, I guess, together. It's a weird movie because it's one of those movies that, like, you know, people that liked David Crowley will like this movie, and people that hate him will use it. Like, there's actually an article about now out that's like, you know, alt-right Nazi lunatic kills family, and there's a movie about it. And, like, there was nothing racist about this guy. There was nothing, you know, alt-right about him. There was nothing crazy about him. Maybe there's something crazy about him. But I don't want to say anything bad about him, and I want to leave it up to people to decide what they think. And really, who the heck knows, man? It's the murder mystery of the century to me. But something I didn't mention that I didn't know about until this movie was his dad, you know, like after the police got all his stuff and rooted through it and pawed on it and made a hasty declaration that it was murder-suicide without really looking into it. Like, I want to know, there's a cop in it they interviewed who was on the scene, and he said, you know, like, they asked him, like, who painted Allah Akbar on the wall, and whose blood was it? And he said, David Crowley painted it as his wife's blood. And I'm like, I want more information, you know? I mean, if someone was going to go in and kill him and make it look like murder-suicide, which would be the worst thing you could do to somebody, you know? Like, that's worse than planning kiddie porn on someone you hate. Like, killing them and their wife and their kid and making it look like they did it. It's the worst thing you could probably do to somebody. And, you know, two people could go in, kill him, kill his family, and then, like, pick up his corpse and write on the wall in his blood. That's possible. So I want more information. And it's really hard to do forensics on this because he was dead for days and days and days. And the dog, I don't think the dog ate him. Dogs don't eat you. Cats do. But the dog was starving and frantic and knocked everything around. Like, everything was chewed on, everything. Like, the dog was crazed because he's in there with him for a week. And so there's this recording. It's his dad holding David's cell phone and playing a recording the last day that they were alive, or the night before, I think. And the first one, like, David gave it the file name of, you know, My Wife's Prophecy was the name of it.
Wow.
Which is really weird. And it's her just, like, weeping and talking about, like, seeing angels and saying that she has already been raptured, but her body's still here, and they need to leave, and they need to leave together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's freaking creepy. And it is her voice, you know. And then, and I don't think she said it under duress, because after that, you know, he's talking. There's another one of him talking calmly with her, and, you know, them talking. They don't sound under duress at all. I don't know, man. It's the murder mystery of the century. So, but, like, he made it so easy to make a movie about him where he looked crazy. Like, he filmed himself talking about the hero's journey, and he has, like, 3x5 cards on a wall in their house, like, covering the wall, like, 25 feet down and 5 feet high, with strings connecting them. Like, every movie about a crazy person ever, like Beautiful Mind, Seven, Fear X, you know, the crazy person always has that on the wall. But he had that, and he's explaining the hero's journey of his movie, and then, like, at the same, and he's talking about how there's multiple levels, like left to right is time, up and down is different levels of understanding of what's going on. And you know, which is film school 101 stuff, but he did it really well. And like while this is happening, the filmmakers are in their film about him are using like he's explaining the hero's journey of the film made about him. It was just too perfect. Like sometimes Herzog is just too clever for his own good sometimes. I love him. Love him as a filmmaker. But you know about the hero's journey there, Phil?
No, I don't.
No. Good. I don't want to teach. I usually teach people, but I'm not going to because you don't know it and you make art that's pure because of it. It's that kind of three-act story like every Hollywood movie pretty much has it. Even documentaries. Like it's, you know, people have a problem. They have to solve the problem. They put together a team of ragtag misfits that you think could never solve the problem. At the end of Act 1, they're all walking in semi-slow motion, dressed for battle. You know, second act is longer. It's all about reaching to where they have to, like, actually find out through a physical journey to what their actual goal is going to be. And then the third act leads up to the battle in the innermost chamber, where the hero is killed and then resurrects. And then there's a denouement of 5 minutes after that to bring you down so you can walk out of the movie theater without getting hit by a car by being too dazed, and it sets it up for a sequel. Oh, darn it. Nice. I told you the hero's journey. Darn it. It's in almost every Hollywood movie. Like, there's plot points. Like, in a 90-minute movie, like, this part happens at 38 minutes, and this part happens at 16 minutes, and yeah. Worms.